through Friday at noon. It is now 1 p.m. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind coming up.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Positive Mind with Ben Starr and Kevin O'Donohue and a few guests. Welcome back in a moment. We bring you ideas, concepts, guests to try and help you lead a more positively minded life. And today we have a very positive message. We have Harville Hendricks back in the studio. Say hello, Harville.
Hello. I'm glad to be back. Thank you.
And Helen LaKelly Hunt.
Hi there.
As you remember, during the fun drive, we offered you the chance to get their groundbreaking couples therapy book, Getting the Love You Want, which has sold over 2 million copies and is coming on its 30th year anniversary in January. So if you got that copy, and many of you did, get ready for the 30th anniversary version. It's really going to be an exciting breakthrough book again. But today we're here to talk to Harville and Helen LaKelly Hunt about taking this couples therapy work to the community. Maybe many of you know the effect of a good marriage on children, but now there's a lot of statistics on the effects of a good marriage on children and on society. And what is the bad effects of a bad marriage on the community and on the children? Harville, can you tell us a little bit about what you're bringing to communities?
We call it safe conversation, which is the an intervention that we are launching and have launched 4 years ago in Dallas through a not-for-profit called Relationships First. And the thing we love about the name of our not-for-profit is that it is not only a good name for a not-for-profit, but it's a value system. Relationships first. And so instead of calling it by some meaningless name, we decided to build what we're doing into the name of the organization. And what that basically is at the bottom line is we help people talk. And many people say, well, doesn't everybody know how to talk? And our answer is, does everybody know how to be married? Does everybody know how to parent a child? Does everybody know how to drive a car? Everything that human beings do is learned. And so the way we talk is also learned. And the major feature of talking is that most of us produce polarization when we talk. That is, we say things and people object to what we say. or just disagree. I think we should turn left. And somebody said, well, I think you should turn right. So that we have a difference, and that out of that difference often comes tension that can lead all the way to disagreement that becomes severe enough that you're actually polarized and can't relate anymore. And part of that's because in talking, there's also not a listening response. In fact, there's a good statistic on listening. There's like 18% accuracy rate on listening, and that means an 82% distortion rate.
I know that old exercise where people sit in a circle and one person is given the lead sentence.
Yes,
and they go around the circle. And by the time it gets to the fifth or sixth person, it's totally lost. The message is lost.
Which is an indication of that distortion rate that happens. In fact, give a little historical background about how come we're doing that.
Yeah.
Is that Helen and I have been in our lane in the bowling alley for about 30 plus years. Has been couples therapy, They called Imago Couples Therapy. And it was actually about 10 years ago, we had a kind of epiphany that saw ourselves as social activists. And Helen is a social activist way before me in the world of women. Yeah. But we also are social activists in the world of couples and in culture. And it dawned on us that while therapy is essential and is a high value, it will never change the world because it mm-hmm. deals with people whose injuries that come to us was caused by the world, beginning with their caretakers in the world, but also the culture itself adds a non-relational quality to it called competition, domination, and control, yeah. pressure
right.
to function.
I love the example that you used about how relationships and conversation are a learned experience, yeah. much like driving.
Yes.
Right? They won't let you on the road without passing a test to
yes.
show that you've learned how to drive.
Yes.
And that's yet, right, exactly. anybody can jump into a conversation or a relationship,
yeah.
you know, without any knowledge.
With no training. And you don't get the right training even in school. You get to learn about vocabulary and words and how to spell and make sentences and write essays, but you don't get the human interactive side of that, which is everybody has a world of their own, and when you speak, their world will be different, and they will object to what you say in some way. So what do you do with that? And if you don't know what to do with that, then you move into disagreement and polarization. You do not move into connection, and it's really very easy to teach it, and it's very easy to learn, but it is not natural. Our natural response right. is, well, that's not the way I see it.
Yeah.
Or you're wrong.
Right.
Where did you get an idea like that? Or something like right. that can escalate into this thing we call polarization, which we think is a world problem. It's a problem between couples, between individuals. It's a problem between nations. It's going on right now in North Korea.
Sure.
We know that, but we can fix that at the micro level if we will learn how to have a conversation that's safe and doesn't produce polarization.
We're going to give you a chance to call in and talk to Harville Hendricks and Helen LaKelly-Hunt, 212-757-5555. We know you're going to want to talk about the couple's work, but we really want calls today to talk about this idea that the problem in our society, the problem in the world is that people do not know how to talk to each other.
Yep.
Where did you learn how to talk? Where did you, as an individual, learn how to talk? So it strikes me, Harville, that a lot of people bring to their relationships the way they learn to talk from childhood,
yes.
from watching their parents talk.
Exactly.
From the dinner table.
How
they related. So think of how many conflicts can just be generated just by everybody coming from a different family,
yeah.
learning to speak and talk in a different way.
Yeah. So, and just a funny story about this, about how Helen and I not knowing how to talk many years ago before we even married were dating, and the first few months of the dating found ourselves she's so intelligent and comprehensive, and I have a little bit of intelligence. So we have a very intense relationship, and we're into fights within the first few weeks of our relationship.
You progressed quickly. So the romantic phase.
It ended in about 3 weeks.
Okay.
So we are having this knockdown, drag-out battle, not knowing how to talk, in Helen's living room. And Helen actually introduces what we want to talk about today, called safe conversation or dialogue, which is another word for it, into our relationship. And she said, stop! Let's one of us talk and the other one listen. And then the other one talk and the
right?
other one listen. Let's take turns like they do in kindergarten. So Helen essentially invented a dialogue at that point, because it impacted me that when we did that, we relaxed, something
right.
settled.
Right.
And then we were able to come back. If I listen long enough, I can't be formulating my response. But if I'm formulating my response, I'm
sure.
not listening. So I found that was so calming for me. And what we can now call it, you move from the lower amygdala up to the prefrontal cortex
right.
in your brain. So I took it to the clinic where I was working with couples
right.
and began to experiment with just rigidly holding couples into that take turns talking thing. And that became, took about 3 years to really figure it all out, but that became a three-step process that we now use as the primary therapeutic tool for all couples,
right.
is that they have to learn how to talk. And you have to do it this way. There's yes. a way to do it that works, and there's a way to do it not working. So I just wanted to give Helen credit for the fact that she was the inventor of transforming the way we had conversations with each other.
And did you find, Helen, that when he started repeating back to you what you said to enact this idea, that he often got it wrong?
Yes.
You could have asked another question. Did he ever get it right?
No, yes. Because, you know, as I work with couples and as I've been exposed to your workshops, and I am fascinated how adults talking to each other and being asked,
yeah.
all I need you to do is say exactly back to me what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That they get it wrong.
Yep.
That sometimes they get a different idea altogether.
Yep.
And so the first step for couples work, and now you're taking it out into the broader context, is for people to report back what I heard you say.
So no comment. and the laughter
woman.
The laughter said a lot.
Right.
But may I go back to the earlier point?
Please,
about,
please go ahead.
So yes, it's hard to really get what someone said. You think you got it, but you didn't.
Right.
And this teachable process helps people learn to listen.
Right.
It's because the culture teaches us how to talk, but no one teaches us how to listen. But what I'd rather go back, Kevin, to is what you and Harville were talking about a little bit ago, the great impact of marriage on children, but also on the community.
Yes.
So there are two things I'd like to say about that.
Sure.
So Harville has this idea out of the clinic into the public. We decide to move back to a smaller city out of New York.
And, smaller than New York.
Yeah,
yes.
A smaller city than New York.
We moved to Queens.
And to see
about that size.
Someone had said this would make a great documentary, the other relationship scientists we were talking to, but they said it would make a great documentary, but do this in one city and see if it makes an impact there. We went to Dallas. We asked if anyone wanted this safe conversation dialogue process. And the people that responded worked in the low-income part of Dallas. There were agencies that serve the parents of the kids in the public schools.
Yes.
They were from financially stressed families.
Right, right.
So Harville and I started doing a 5-hour workshop for these financially stressed couples. The impact on these couples was so transformational. They were in tears. They, at the end of the first hour, we had them do an appreciation and mirror each other back. They had tears in their eyes that no one had ever given them an appreciation in
right.
their whole life.
Yeah.
Like, and
really?
And part of a healthy marriage is, as David Brooks said in his article last week in the New York Times, giving appreciations is part of a healthy marriage. And Harville and I do that. That's what we teach as well. So anyway, the mayor got word with what we were doing in this low-income part of Dallas, South Dallas. He put us on the mayor's poverty task force. And the chair of the mayor's poverty task force said, all these haves, people with money and people with stuff, come to South Dallas and give people something because they're poor.
Right.
He said, you all come into South Dallas and you give them tools and you tell them they can fix their own problem.
Right.
And Harville and I began to do the research. The exacerbation of, let's see, when families fall apart and are headed toward divorce, it exacerbates the downward spiraling of poverty. And he said, if you all can strengthen the families in South Dallas, you'll be strengthening the economics of the city. So we have been studying that, and we have a lot of statistics about if the family stays strong, it strengthens the economics of the city. So the last thing I'd like to say about that is we are doing this in Dallas, and we found out about a group that is doing it in 3 other cities in the United States, experimenting with distributing family-strengthening information into the city to, quote, lower the divorce rate or to, quote, improve the economics of the city. They're keeping their work secret, but there are four cities doing this. And once we get we're in conversation with them. We are going to one day bring this out into the world. And so y'all on the radio listening are some of the first people that are hearing about this. It is working in Dallas, and we're doing the statistics now about how it's saving the city money.
Yeah, and I think it's something people know in themselves anyway, on a certain level, that when you come from a dysfunctional environment or a conflict-rich environment, that the children are going to suffer. And if the children are going to suffer, then the society is going to suffer.
They suffer at school. The kids don't do well in school. Then some drop out. They get pregnant.
Right.
They get on
drug abuse.
Drugs. And then they don't get jobs. And then the city they go on welfare. You're right. And then they aren't able to support themselves. So it is a real drain on society.
Yeah. And the piece I want to add to that is our society, our culture, says that those people who drop out and do all that stuff are kind of inadequate. They have it's their fault in some way.
Yes.
What is the fact, but it's so controversial, is that it's not their fault. That a drug addict's problem is not the fault of the drug addict. It's the culture which does not really understand that all of those things are relational. Stress are results of relational stress. You do not become an addict unless if you have a great relationship as a child with your caretakers and an adult with another significant person.
Right.
Because addiction is a compensation for the pain and a medication for the pain of ruptured relationships. And so what we're trying to say to the culture is we have to have a different culture. If you want to solve all these problems, you can't solve them by focusing on the problems. You have to solve them by focusing on what causes those problems.
Right.
And that has to do with the fact that our culture is an individualistically focused culture and does not focus on the power, on the fact of relationship.
If you're just joining us, you're tuned into The Positive Mind here on 99.5 FM WBAI. We're taking your calls, 212-757-5555. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue, as always. Our guest today, Dr. Harville Hendricks and Helen LeKelly-Hunt, the authors of Getting the Love You Want, who are joining us here for the second time this year. It's great to have you back, and it's great to hear about all this new work that you're doing. So one more time, number to call, 212-757-5555.
And yes, Ben, I think we should accept callers talking about how this work, the Imago Therapy work, has changed their lives. We'll welcome those calls also. We wanted to focus on the community building, but I'm sure people know this aspect of your work first. And this is new, so I can't expect people to call in about something they haven't experienced. But if you have experienced Imago Therapy, if you've read Getting the Love You Want, if you've ever wanted to talk to Harville Hendricks, what do you mean I'm attracted to the person who's going to frustrate me? What do you mean? What does that mean? Oh, no way. You mean it's not my fault? Here's your chance to give us a call, 212-757-5555. You call it, Harville, upriver
prevention.
Upriver prevention.
To prevent downriver cleanup.
Downriver cleanup. Just think about it. What is the effect of one healthy family in a community?
Yes,
right? I mean, they are doing and studying the effects of one healthy family in a community.
Yes. And they're also doing the other side of that, which is the cost of one divorce. And the cost of one divorce at the base is $33,000. But that's just what it costs to go through the divorce process. The people who are working with those numbers are saying it probably costs more like $300,000 or maybe up to $1 million if you add all the collateral cost of the children growing up as a result of that rupture, all the problems that they will bring to their context and that they will have and the needs from society they will have. And like Dallas has enough divorce. I think the Dallas divorce cost now is about $33 million a year, and the culture itself is over $3 billion.
Yeah. I'm sure it's even higher, to be honest with you. Once you're part of a single-parent family, 73% of lowest income bracket, you're automatically – you lose income.
Yes.
A divorce lowers the income of the family.
Exactly.
Cuts it in half.
Cuts it in half.
And how is that going to affect children?
Yes.
Almost 50% of households with children undergoing divorce move into poverty following the divorce.
Yep.
40% of families that are divorced or separated move to single-parent households. 75% of all women who apply for welfare benefits do so because of a disrupted marriage or relationship.
Yep.
So, you know, it's a good predictor that if you're going to be divorced or going to get a divorce, you're going to need public assistance.
Yes.
So this is a governmental issue, a governmental problem.
Yes. And a governmental problem, but to go back to this, the government itself is a function of the value system of the culture, because so many in government think that these people who have all these needs are indigent or incapable or lazy self-indulgent and so forth. And what they're trying to do is manage their pain. The pain of the ruptured connection. And so that puts some people into depression. So therefore,
which makes you even more immovable.
More immovable, and also onto the welfare of the culture. You have to go get some help. Puts you into anger, which then leads to violence, and that's a result of relational stress. So the costs just reverberate throughout all kinds of symptoms. In fact, the case can be made that all emotional or mental health symptoms are of functions of relational stress.
212-757-5555. We do have Steve on the line. Steve, thanks for giving us a call today.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love the work that you're doing, and it's great to hear this topic on the air. I'm an administrator in a school, and I wonder, when students and young people don't get the opportunity at home to learn great communication skills, what could be done in the schools? And oftentimes, in order to have something done across the school, you've got to get the administration and the Board of Ed involved and the Department of Education. What are some things that teachers and administrators and people who work in schools can do to help facilitate this level of communication amongst young people?
Great call.
Go ahead. Respond to that.
I'll just say that in addition to this information needing to be required if you get a marriage license, we believe that there should be 4 R's taught in school: reading, writing, arithmetic, and relationship. It is ridiculous. Some of the courses, like you know, geometry, or these very abstract or whatever. And in college, they're taking hieroglyphics or learning interesting things. But everybody needs to learn to talk and. This stuff can be taught in grade school. I'm so sorry we don't have it ready yet. But so what can be done, Harville? Oh, one of the things we're experimenting with is going into schools and teaching it to the parents of the kids in schools.
Yeah. Yep. Or the teachers.
Yep.
I mean, when a kid violates a school rule or in a classroom rule, don't you want to hear from him what he's done wrong so that you can mirror it back to him? So, I mean, it's a kind of way for them to acknowledge it's not a school rule. It's a proper functioning environment.
Yeah.
That it's no longer a rule. It becomes things work when you do things this way. And for the child to, you know, engage in a mirroring process with another person or an adult or a teacher, administrator, they get to understand what it is they've done.
Yes.
So,
right.
I mean, to me, it's basic. Steve, I'm not sure. Have you read Getting the Love You Want? Do you know of Harville and Helen's work?
No, I'm only hearing about it now. And some of the work that you've been talking about in the last couple of weeks about marrying back, I've been trying to apply it in my own life. But, you know, I'm wondering just how individuals within school systems can try to start to incorporate that into their classroom and administrative practices.
So we can, we have had, we have 7 schools that are in the Safe Conversation Project in Dallas, and one of them has integrated Safe Conversations into their school, so much so that they have become and have they've self-designated themselves as the first Safe Conversation school.
Lucky them. What's the name of the school?
At Crystal Ray.
Crystal Ray.
Crystal Ray. Right. And what happened there was that we, someone from the school system came to one of our public workshops, and they had this thought, and which was wonderful for us, is what can I do with this other than with my relationship with my partner, because there was a teacher in the school.
Right.
So she wrangled a 2-hour seminar with the teachers at the school. So Helen and I went out, talked about it, demonstrated it, and so forth. And they liked it. They responded to that. So we went from that 2-hour thing to now the full distribution of Safe Conversations throughout the whole school system, so much so that the students that are senior – train the freshman students coming in the fall of every year in Safe Conversation as a part of the on-ramp into the school community.
Great. Yeah.
So this school is experiencing something that is really new. One is there's no acting out, no violence. People are showing up for class. Grades have gotten higher, and all-round social functioning is increased. Most of these kids also have jobs. They have to have jobs because it's economically low in scale. So they go to corporations every day to have an internship. And their capacity to function in those organizations is like adults with lots of experience, because they know how to form a sentence. Uh-huh. They know how to start a conversation. They know how to mirror somebody back.
Right.
They know how to say, let me see if I got that, to check out whether they got it or not. Mm. So their relational skills has escalated, and their value then to the company as well as to the school has increased. So our goal is that every school in the world could have Safe Conversations in it. You would have that sort of thing, because when you have relational connecting, you have safety. And when you have safety, you don't have many other problems, because people act out when they're scared. Right. And if you can help them be safe, and you can make a conversation safe with every transaction, make it safer and safer. So that's one of the things we can do. And we have projects on the way to that level in 6 other schools in the city right now.
I would say, Steve, this is particularly effective between an adult and a child.
Yes.
It's such a gift. It's a beautiful thing to witness. So if you're an administrator, I don't know if you have chances to be a disciplinarian, but to have a child alone in your office mirroring back to you what they've done and summarizing what they've done and tuning into the feeling of what they've done. And these are the simple skills, skills that Helen and Harville teach. Mirror back, validate, summarize, empathize. That's it. And when you do it as an adult to a child, it takes shame out of the picture and really helps a child feel like an adult gets them.
Yep.
Helen, go right ahead.
One teacher told us that she was using it in a classroom, or she was just thinking about using it. And there were a couple kids who are always talking back. This was junior high. And they were disrespectful. They didn't do what she said as a teacher. They wouldn't get their homework in. They wouldn't obey. And they were being snide and whispering themselves. And she would try to get them – she would try to punish them. Say, I'm going to take you to the principal's office. And she would say, stop that and stop that. She said she started mirroring them back and saying, let me see if I've got it. And then she would say, is there more about that?
Right.
And it was so disarming for the kids. And they would go, well, let me listen. What is the issue? And she turned into, instead of being a judge and trying to control the classroom, she let their voice matter and listen. And it began to transform.
Steve, we have about 30 seconds. If you need to comment, feel free.
Oh, no, this is just great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Steve.
There's
such great potential, I think, between adults and children with this science, technology of communication. What do you call it?
That's good.
Technology of communication. Relational technology.
Yeah.
And to summarize, it's mirroring, it's summarizing, it's validating, and it's empathizing. And I think the appreciative aspect piece of it is also important, too. Ben?
We're going to take just a short musical break, and we'll be back after this with more of your calls. 212-757-5555. Back after this.
Thank you very much for being so wonderful to us tonight. Thank you. A song from fading too fast. How do you lose yourself to someone and never lose your way? How do you not run out of new things to say? And since we know we're always changing, why should it be the same? Tell me how, year after year, you're sure your heart will fall apart each time you hear a name. I know the way I feel for you. It's now or never. The more I love, the more that I'm afraid that in your eyes I may not see forever. Forever. If we can be the best of lovers, yet be the best of friends. If we can try with every day to make it better as it grows. With any luck, then I suppose the music
Tony Bennett here on The Positive Mind, 99.5 FM WBAI. We're here Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 1 p.m. I'm Ben Starr here with Kevin O'Donohue as always, and our guest today,
Harville Hunt and Helen LaKelly Hunt. And we also have a new, and we also, Harville Hendricks rather, and Helen LaKelly Hunt. Why is it men never take the last name of the woman they marry? There's another question. That's going to happen in 20, 30 years from now. Yeah. Who knows?
Yes.
Anyway, we do have Haley on the line. So, Haley, if you're there, you have a question for Harville Hendricks and Helen LaKelly Hunt?
Yes, howdy, it's Haley.
Hi.
Wow, you're a young woman. How old are you?
I am 21 years old.
21 years old.
Oh, my God.
Phil, yes. We are privileged to have a 21-year-old listen to our program and to call in. Please tell us what you'd like to ask.
So I am currently in Philadelphia living in an intentional community of 18 other people from all kinds of different backgrounds and ages, and we were getting into a discussion the other day about men and women communicating. And some women in the group said that after some experiences of being in fields or in conversations dominated by men, they now feel as though they have to be invited into the conversation, because if they speak on their own or put themselves in the conversation, they feel they're not listened to or they're dismissed when their audience is primarily men. And so I was wondering how gender plays into communication, and if there's any statistics about how possibly men have a harder time listening to or retaining information when it comes from a woman as opposed as coming from another male.
Wow.
Great question.
Are there any statistics on that?
No.
Well, I can respond to that. I can't respond with statistics, but I can respond to the...
And I would say that both men and women have trouble listening accurately.
Yeah.
Because there is not that technology that teaches that.
So I think there are two pieces to this. And one is that is the gender issue, which is a false issue that's been created in Western civilization about men and women. And that basic issue is that women are statistically, but also judgmentally, considered to be non-rational. That's and technically we call that right brain dominant, and therefore they're intuitive, and their thinking is more circular and integrated. Men are left brain dominant, and their thinking is logical, rational, and linear. But that's what's been valued in the Western world for the past 200 years. And women's voices and the intuitive voice, which is in fact the wiser voice, because the intuitive voice is a receptor of more information to talk about than the left brain or the linear voice. So part of it is a gender bias about women's intelligence. You remember the Harvard president who said, to his great detriment a few years ago,
yes, that's right,
about women were not good in science, which is factually not correct, is that women are not invited in and hired into scientific professions. But three women who were African-American figured out how to get the astronauts back from the moon. And they were not given any credit until recently when a movie came out about them.
Right.
So part of it is gender. But the second thing is that Helen said both men and women have difficulty listening. And that's because of the human thing that we all are always listening to our own movie. And we're running a movie in our heads all the time.
Yes.
And we're watching the images on the screen. And therefore, when somebody else speaks to us, it's like they're knocking on our movie house theater saying, can I put my movie on your screen so that you could hear me talk?
Mm.
And unless you do what we call in Safe Conversations, make an appointment, say, is now a good time to talk about? If you run your movie, you just run your movie on my screen without my permission, I'm going to maybe, if I'm a nice guy, I'm going to kind of kowtow to that, but I'll be mad.
Right.
But usually it's like you're interrupting me, and so therefore I'm going to push you out. So what we have invited both men and women to, and this is true, that's not a gender issue. That's a human issue. And what we've invited everybody to learn to do is the first rule of a safe conversation is ask for an appointment to talk. And it's very simple. It's now a good time to talk with you about whatever the topic is. And if the person says, not a good time for me, then you don't talk about it, because what they're saying is, I'm running a movie in my head right now, and I don't have any room on my screen for your movie. Therefore, I couldn't see it anyway.
Right.
Come back in 10 minutes, and I'll turn off my movie, or come back in 2 hours or 2 days.
Love it.
I'll turn off my movie, and then we'll run your movie, and I will watch it, and then we can talk about it. And maybe we'll take turns. I'll run your movie. you know, and yeah. you run my movie, and then we'll both know what each other's movies is. That is a skill that has to do with developing relational competency, which is essential for being able to have a relationship without polarization.
Haley, did you get all of that?
Yes.
What do you think?
I was briefly interrupted by these 18 people I'm living with.
Oh,
yes.
Don't let them do that. So there aren't any statistics, I mean, about, and I would caution you to not tell men that, you know, 63% of men don't listen. I don't know, really know what that is, but I don't know that there's any statistics out there about men and women listening differently. Certainly, there might be a science.
There probably are some, but the gender assignment of the difficulty of listening is a false assignment.
Okay.
The problem is the cultural devaluation of women.
Women's list. Yeah.
And the fact that that has been a crime for 10,000 years.
Right.
And it's time that gender negative bias about women's intelligence is over with.
And so I'd like to make a point. Hmm. When both men and women learn this technology, both of them become transformed
right.
in their capacity. To take turns talking.
Yeah.
They had no idea that they're supposed to do that, and they had no idea, they hadn't reflected upon the fact we're taught how to talk, but we aren't taught how to listen, and mirroring helps you listen better. But what's exciting, and back to the theme of this show, Kevin, is that this can transform all of our homes, all of our houses, but it can also transform the houses of Congress. Because right. that's where yeah. it's also needed. Yeah. And we elect our best and brightest to – there are best and brightest to,
so they should
to
be
represent
able to learn
us.
This.
Yeah. Well, and look how good a shape
– yes.
you know, what good a job is Congress doing
yeah.
to help the country? Yeah. Like they are getting really low marks
sure.
these the last decade.
Yeah.
Like it's not working. It's so broken. Like so many houses are broken and homes are broken. What if, Harville and I fantasize, what if in Congress, right before you're to present a bill, so, and the House is polarized on it. Well, say the process is the head of the whatever knocks the gavel and said session is in order.
Speaker of the House.
And before the Speaker of the House calls the session in order, and this says, now before we debate the bill, we'd like you to turn to the senator next to you or the congressman
whoever.
And woman mm-hmm. next to you and give them an appreciation.
Wow.
And, yeah, wow.
And then
after you give that person an appreciation, the person who got the appreciation has to mirror back.
Yep.
And then the person that just received the appreciation returns and gives an appreciation of the other.
Wow.
Now, they may vote differently, but let's just start
yeah.
the session with a moment where there's something that you like and admire about the other person. Brain science says what you focus on is what you get. And if you can only see what you disagree with, that's who that person becomes. But there are also things you have in common. So what if one day our culture is wise enough to let everyone vote differently and create an atmosphere in the houses of Congress that could be about mutual respect and mutual regard, even though they disagree?
Mm.
And that, we think, should be the goal mm-hmm. in Congress and in yep. politics.
Haley, thanks for your call. Before you go, I wanted to ask you, what man in your life is not listening to you?
All of them. Trump.
Well, start local, you know. But, I mean, there might be one guy in particular. I think.
And model it. Model listening to them, mirroring them.
Yeah.
And that's how they'll learn it, is when you do it.
Yeah. And I just want to amplify that most people ask, how can I get my whoever to do
sure,
whatever?
Right.
And the answer is what Helen just said. Model it so they'll see what it looks like instead of saying, you're not listening. Model listening, and then they will see what listening looks
right,
like
right.
so you can make a difference.
Hey, the last thing, I would say try to send an appreciation out to a man you want to have a conversation with. say, you know, I'd like to start a conversation with you, but first I'd like to tell you what I appreciate about you.
And if you start dating that person, you might say, hey, every night, why don't we text each other one appreciation so that you're both doing it for each other? It's just like that transformed our marriage when Harville and I started at the end of the day giving each other three appreciations.
Haley, thanks for calling.
So I think one thing I'd like to add to a conversation like this for everybody who's listening is we are talking about the technology of relationship, but there is a primary quality that has to be created for relationships to work, which is safety.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how many skills you use, if you do not create a safe environment, those skills will be ineffective in connecting.
Right.
And the skills we're talking about create the safety we're talking about.
Right.
And once the safety is created, it's amazing what then people can do,
mm-hmm.
because instead of spending their time defending themselves,
mm-hmm.
protecting themselves from what is an insult or they fear might be one, they can be creative.
Mm-hmm.
And creativity then produces all kinds of things that make the world better, which are difficult to do if you're scared of each other. And so safety is, we say, is non-negotiable quality of a healthy, thriving relationship.
And I have to say that one of the things that you do is you have people sit across from each other and make eye contact.
Yes.
I mean, so it's impossible, like you say, to have a conversation with somebody that you don't feel safe with. The starting of the conversation with pause, breathe in, slow it down, and look into the eyes of the person across from you. It can be that simple to create the safety, at least the beginning of safety. So this is not, you know, part of what we're talking about, mirroring, summarizing, validating, empathizing. But this is part of the imago.
Part of that. And the reason we do the eye contact is has to do with safety, because when you are looking at someone, you can read the size of each other's pupils. You cannot consciously read it, but you register it below the level of consciousness and verbal.
Right.
And you know you're registering it because you either feel safe when you're looking at this person or you feel tense.
Right.
And what creates the tension is the pupil is constricted. And therefore, your brain says not available.
Really?
And if the pupil is open, really wide, the brain says, "Oh, open, safe."
Mm-hmm.
And the eye contact is not just a romantic thing; it's actually a technical, scientific thing, so that the brains can read each other's availability for this conversation. But the fascinating thing is that when you make the eye contact and hold it for 3 to 5 deep breaths, both people will relax
and the pupil will open.
And the pupil will open.
Wow. 212-757-5555. We have room for maybe one more call. 212-757-5555. So the technology, let's talk about a little bit about what's succeeding right now. What's the promise of this work? There are places where it's in place. I know that I read a county in Florida that's instituting this. Has a 17% less divorce rate than every other county in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That the divorce rate has gone down 1% in other counties in Florida, but in this one county, is it Daytona? I mean, is it not Tallahassee?
Jacksonville.
Yeah, the divorce rate has gone down 17%.
So that's one of the three other places other than Dallas. So, yep.
Yeah, that's not our project, but that's this other
Dennis
project.
Stroika is doing that.
Okay, so that's relationship and marriage education, right?
But
this is what you're doing. You are educating people.
Well, yeah, right. It's not therapy.
It's
trying to prevent the need for therapy, but we call it relationship education, and that it's fundamentally helping people have a conversation. And so this county that's doing something similar, that's a more comprehensive program, is producing this divorce rate. We've not targeted divorce reduction, but the increase in the number of people who are practicing the process. We could do that, but you have to set up a baseline and then measure it again.
Yeah.
And we've not done that. But it's just an indication that if you give people relationship information, it changes their lives.
Sure.
And we would think that should be a primary value system of the culture and of the schools and universities and churches and so forth.
Absolutely.
But most information has to do with the Western value system of competition. Who's the best and who's going to win? And that produces anxiety and defenses and therefore less functioning.
And the biggest issue in conflict in a divorce proceeding is I'm not going to lose.
That's exactly. Yeah.
Right.
And I'm going to get the best lawyer. I'm going to get the best deal. Yeah, right. It's all about me.
So I think one thing you did say is that when people enter Imago therapy, that you ask them to commit to not leaving the relationship for 12 sessions, which I think is brilliant. I mean, I think it's great. If you can't get them to commit to anything else, if you are thinking about divorce, if you're thinking of breaking up the family, commit to 12 sessions of this. And I would think that at least you would break up more peacefully if you do continue, if you do decide to go through with the divorce, because you're going to have plenty of opportunities to feel what your partner is feeling as you're going through this.
Yeah.
That is such a good point. I've never heard anyone say it that way, Kevin, that at least you, if you decide to part, you'll do it more peacefully. And to me, when you said that, it made me think about the fact that if you practice safe conversation, you change your brain.
Absolutely.
And you change your brain in any relationship with that person as well as with any other person. So the part of the brain you change is when your partner says something and maybe you don't agree, or even maybe you do agree, but you have your thing to say back. If you say what you think back, it's coming from the lower brain often, especially if your partner said upset you.
Yeah.
If you're upset with what your partner said, they can hardly get the sentence out of their mouth, and you say back to them, you know I disagree. I've heard you say this before. You know I think it's differently, and you are in the lower brain. But if your partner says something and you disagree with it, if you first go, well, let me see if I've got it, and you mirror them, and then you say, is there more, and did I get it right, and is there more? And then you validate, and then you empathize. And then you should say your point of view. You'll be calming down your brain while you're marrying your partner. Marrying your partner can be a spiritual experience, like a faith practice, where you practice like meditating on your partner's words. It's like going off and doing because you have to empty your brain in order to marry your partner well.
Yes.
And it can be a spiritual practice for those who use it.
I'd like to make a comment about the 12 sessions. This is giving away a therapeutic secret to the public, so you may never go to an Imago therapist again. But the paradox of the 12 sessions for the divorcing couple, it works in a little different way for the couple not divorcing. The divorcing couple is that you don't try to talk them out of the divorce. You simply say, okay, 12 sessions. And during the 12 sessions, while they're talking about the divorce, you train them in the relational process of listening, mirroring, validating. And what I discovered, I set it up initially just so they would have a better divorce. But what began happening was they didn't get divorced.
Exactly.
They learned the skill. They began to be understand each other, be empathic with each other, which they had never done.
Right.
And they'd get to the point of saying, do we need this divorce now?
Exactly.
I'm beginning to like you again, and so forth. So we do it now as a kind of paradox. But if you just want to talk logically about, you know, working out the details, that would not work. But you train them in the skills of connecting while talking about separating, and the paradox is that they reconnect.
Right.
And then they stay married.
The technology works, folks. It really works. Yeah. You sit with somebody, and they become vulnerable. And And I think unconsciously, I don't know what the science of this is, and it was interesting when you talked about looking into the other's eye, that unconsciously we see whether their pupil is open or closed. But what happens unconsciously, I think, in this is that you see the vulnerability and it reminds you, oh, I fell in love with this person because of this. And we've stopped having these kinds of conversations. Many people go to couples therapy and they sit across from the therapist and the therapist sort of mediating between the two, bouncing back from one to the other.
Yep.
In this work, they look at each other and they get a chance to actually feel the feelings and the things that they really want to talk about.
Yeah.
So it works. This technology works, and now we're so privileged and happy that you bring it to communities. Helen?
By the way, if you're looking for a therapist, and almost everyone would do good to get a therapist with a session with a therapist now and then, Carol Kramer-Sklepian is just awesome.
Yeah,
she is here in New York, and there are others in New York, and you can go to the Imago website.
Yeah.
And Carol's information is listed there, and so many others.
I think there are about 100 people in New York that are trained.
Yes, and do yourself a favor. It's like I considered it a spa for the relationship when you, instead of struggling on your own, get some help. You'll feel so much better.
Love it. Helen LaKelly-Hunt, thanks for closing it up for us. Harville Hendricks, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again,
for having us.
It's called Safe Conversations. You cannot connect with anybody if you don't feel safe. And
right.
The beginning of this work is for people to do it one-on-one with each other and then to spread it out and bring it to communities, bring it to Congress, bring it to our public officials, bring it to low-income communities. And that's really where you're starting. Is that right?
Yeah, we started in low ends, and there we began to understand how it applies actually to every ecosystem. I think our ultimate goal is the UN.
Fantastic. That's national and international, folks, the UN. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The Positive Mind. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, 1 p.m. Stay tuned.